I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a roundup from the road as presidential primaries are just, well, for the moment, 10 weeks away. But first, this fire is 0% contained. That's a quote from Malibu, California Mayor Pamela Ulrich speaking about the up to 15 fires that have burned 35,000 acres from an area north of Santa Barbara, south to San Diego, with Malibu and other towns in between. All 36,000 residents in Ramona and northern San Diego County have been evacuated. San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders says he expects that fire to burn its way into the northern part of the city today. Another 1,500 people are being evacuated in upscale Malibu, where 700 firefighters are battling strong winds. And we're joined now at the San Diego fire, southeast of Los Angeles, by reporter Claudia Pescuto, who's been covering the story for KNX 1070 News Radio. Claudia, tell us, first of all, what are you looking at?
I'm on the 241 Atoll Road. This is near Irvine, and it's closed right now because of this fire. I'm looking at smoke on both sides of the toll road, and they've been trying to keep the fire on one side of the toll road, but unfortunately it has jumped to the other side. At one point, you could see red, orange, and yellow flames burning along the toll road. There was a huge wall of black smoke that came up, and, you know, the sun has come up now, but it's obscured by all the smoke up here, and firefighters have just been working throughout the night to stop this fast-moving wildfire. In 12 hours or so, it burned about 8,800 acres, basically just whipped around by these winds. And the resources are very scarce in the Southern California region right now because of all the fires that are burning. So that's taxing both the firefighter resources and also the resources to fight this from the air.
But we understand you are sort of positioned near some familiar landmarks, Disneyland, Los Angeles. I mean, you seem to be east of these areas. Is there a sense that the fire is going to make its way further west?
Well, right now the fire is staying away from homes. There are no evacuation orders in place on the Santiago fire. But this is a highly populated area. The fire is burning near a lot of homes. And the thing is, with the Santa Ana winds, they can pick up very quickly and, you know, they will just start blowing embers around, and then you can get hot spots far away from where the flames are actually burning. So obviously not out of the woods yet. And the Santa Ana winds are not only strong, they're also very dry.
Claudia, it would seem that people would be most concerned right now with putting out the fires and staying out of their way. But is there debate over why they're raging so much? We've heard with global warming, there are going to be more fires, they'd be stronger in nature. Is there a sense that it has something to do with that, with the weather, with the drought, or, you know, a man-made problem like too much undergrowth?
My impression is that our terrain was made to burn, and because of all the home building going on, we don't have the regular fires that should burn to thin out some of the brush. So you start building homes, you don't have fires on a regular basis, so that brush starts to build up, and then it can burn very quickly.
Yeah. Can you characterize these fires for us? We've almost become accustomed to hearing of fires at a certain time of year, especially in the Malibu area. Is there a sense that these are somehow worse, more, you know, unexpected strength? What's the sense of what's happening today?
I think what people are worried about is that we're going to have a fire season similar to the one that we had in 2003, where we had several large, very dangerous, destructive wildfires, and conditions, again, are very poor. October is when we start to see a lot of fire activity, and you know, I personally cannot remember the last time I heard about 13 to 15 wildfires all burning at the same time.
Claudia, why are firefighters so overwhelmed, and why has there been a state of emergency declared by the governor to get new resources? And one would think California in particular would be prepared for wildfires.
I think the issue is that we've had so many spark up at the same time. For example, I'm on the Santiago fire. This one actually is believed to have been started by arson. That's going to be a big concern, obviously, for authorities. But the issue is that all it takes is, you know, a little spark here and there. And with those strong winds, clocked up to 108 miles an hour, we had a report of that yesterday. It doesn't take much to get these fires to spread very quickly and cause a lot of damage.
That's reporter Claudia Pescuda for KNX 1070 News Radio in California. She's at the site of the Santiago Fire in Irvine, California, southeast of Los Angeles. There are 15 fires raging from the north, Santa Barbara, down to San Diego. Claudia, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, if you weren't watching the Red Sox beat the Cleveland Indians to make it into the World Series, they'll face the Colorado Rockies. If you weren't watching that last night, maybe you tune into the ninth and perhaps most heated debate among Republicans running for president. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee called it a demolition derby. John McCain attacked Romney, Fred Thompson attacked Rudy Giuliani, and that was just in the opening minutes. Then they all remembered to attack the Democratic frontrunner, Mitt Romney, accusing Hillary Clinton of never having run anything, likening her experience to an internship. Meanwhile, Senator Clinton defended her stand on Iran in a letter to Iowans. Well, joining us with a wrap-up of the campaign trail, 10 weeks before the first pre-election vote is cast. Oh, wait, maybe that will change to 9 weeks. We have two veteran political watchers joining us. John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and senior contributing writer to The Wall Street Journal. John, welcome as always.
Hey, Robin.
And also joining us today, Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. She says she was born to cover politics because she was born in Iowa on Election Day. What more do we need to hear? Kay, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Kay, let's start with you. Iowans will once again lead off presidential voting. Republicans will vote on January 3rd. They moved that date up from the 14th. Democrats in Iowa haven't set their date yet. Well, first of all, just give us, handicapping is a terrible word, but that's what we'd like you to do. How do you see the race shaping up in Iowa?
Well, Romney has held a steady lead with about 30% for the past several months. I think those of us on the ground here see Huckabee making a move. He is sort of consolidating support among social conservatives. He did quite well, as Mr. Harwood knows, over the weekend at the Values Voters Summit.
This is former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, yes, with the summit in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Correct. He did very well at that summit. In last night's debate, he, as you mentioned, gave that sort of quip that he is known for, the demolition derby quip. But he also inserted himself later in the debate in a discussion about Turkey and Iraq, I think to illustrate his homework and the idea that he would be prepared to face foreign policy challenges if he were the party's nominee. And so I think Huckabee is the person that we are watching here in Iowa.
And Huckabee, John Harwood, came in just 30 votes behind Mitt Romney in the Value Voters poll of social conservatives. We spoke to the Family Research Council on Friday, and a spokesperson said to us that they absolutely embraced Mike Huckabee for his social values. But how is he faring nationwide? Is the national picture the same as the Iowa snapshot we just got of Republicans?
Not at all. Mike Huckabee is not raising money on anywhere like the scale of his rivals. And in the national polls, he's still stuck in the 5-6% range. But I think Kay is making exactly the right point. Mike Huckabee's not all that far from second place in Iowa. I'm looking right now at a computer screen with the Real Clear Politics average that shows him just a point or so behind Fred Thompson and trailing Mitt Romney. So Mike Huckabee is a force to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. And I should add, Robin, through the miracles of the channel return button on the remote control, some people were able to watch both the baseball game and the debate last night.
Good for you. By the way, Sam Brownback pulled out of the race just before that Values Voters Conference. He was another one who had been embraced for his stand on social issues. Can you see in Huckabee's success, can you see some of Brownback's support going to Huckabee, Kay?
No. Huckabee had virtually no support in Iowa, and so I don't think it's a bonanza for any of the candidates.
Yeah. How about on the Democratic side in Iowa, Kay?
It's unlike the national race. You have sort of a three-way contest among Clinton, Edwards, and Obama. The Des Moines Register did an Iowa poll a couple of weeks ago, which showed Clinton sort of edging up, but the margin of error in that poll was something like 5 percentage points. So it's a statistical dead heat among those three, and it's sort of been that way since January and February. So this has been an interesting race in Iowa because it's completely, totally different than what you're seeing in national polls.
Right. John, remind us the national picture.
Well, the national picture, Hillary Clinton is pulling away. She has leads in the 20 percentage point range over Barack Obama, not to mention John Edwards and everybody else. But I think the point is, Robin, as long as one of those candidates has a chance of defeating Hillary Clinton in Iowa. They have a chance of getting that slingshot effect and instantly changing the picture in New Hampshire and other states, depending, of course, on how this all this calendar madness works out, because that's something that may present us with an equation that we haven't seen in a while.
Well, let's talk about that and put aside for just a second your thoughts. I have questions about how Hillary is running her campaign in Iowa, maybe because she's so neck and neck there. But let's talk about when, in fact, they may be voting. I mean, we know that they are moving up steadily. Republican Party leaders today recommended punishing states that have moved up their primary dates by stripping them of half their convention delegates. And, Kay, it seems that that may mean a very empty arena at the convention. How's that looking? I mean, how many have moved up?
Well, obviously, the calendar is in turmoil. In Iowa, as you noted, Iowa Republicans voted last week to set the date of their caucuses on January 3rd. Iowa Democrats still have theirs scheduled for January 14th. Iowa Democrats, it seems to me, are waiting for Secretary of State Bill Gardner in New Hampshire to make his decision, and he has until November to make that decision. So I don't think you're going to see any real finality to this calendar until he makes his decision of when the New Hampshire primary will be held.
Right, and John, go ahead.
And what's interesting about all of these states, such as Michigan, such as Florida, which have taken moves to advance the dates of their contests, in hopes of luring candidates away from states like Iowa and New Hampshire, the converse happens. It makes Iowa and New Hampshire more important because a candidate can't afford to stumble in the early state contests and hope to maintain momentum for the nomination.
Right. The candidates have already, many said they wouldn't even go to Michigan because they can't afford to suddenly go and try to build up there what they don't have. But, John, we understand that on ABC this week, George Stephanopoulos said New Hampshire's primary director told him that that state probably isn't going to move earlier than January 3rd, the Iowa date. But do you think that thinking is going to hold?
I do, Robin. I think if the New Hampshire Secretary of State were to move that primary into December, he could kill the influence of the New Hampshire primary this year because there's a natural break point at the holidays. I think it would encourage people to discount the results of New Hampshire and then get past New Year's Day and focus on Iowa. The real question is going to be how crowded these states are to one another and what sort of effect will Iowa, the sort of synergetic I didn't say that right, did I?
That's all right. The synergy
between Iowa and New Hampshire has been pretty powerful over the last few years. Somebody rides a rocket out of Iowa and then does well in New Hampshire. If there's only a few days in between, do they get the same effect? Do they get a greater effect? We don't really know.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and senior contributing writer of the Wall Street Journal. We're also speaking to Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. We're going to be back with both of them. We want to ask Kay about that letter that Senator Clinton sent out to Iowans over the weekend defending her vote on Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist group. We'll find out more about that. And don't forget, later in the program, we're going to take a look at the history of the space shuttle as another gets ready to launch tomorrow. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. We're continuing our Monday conversation, scanning the presidential politics horizon with Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, and John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, senior contributing writer to The Wall Street Journal. And Kay, I want to ask you there in Iowa about the letter that Senator Clinton sent out, three pages to Iowans over the weekend, defending her vote last month, naming Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist group. She's been criticized for that, saying that that vote might give the Bush administration a green light to attack Iran. What does her letter say to you politically? And is it, you know, are people talking about it?
People are talking about it because this has been a big issue on the campaign trail for her. As many of your listeners may know, she was challenged on this very issue during a forum in Iowa in which a gentleman from the audience asked her a question about her vote on this. And it just kept percolating for the past couple of weeks. And so her campaign has enough resources to send a letter to Iowa Democrats, which they have done. And it sort of highlights this debate that Obama and Clinton have been having for the past couple of months about the prosecution of U.S. foreign policy by the next president. Obama, as you may remember, made that remark about his willingness to, meet with dictators from foreign countries during the CNN YouTube debate.
Mm-hmm.
And things have just spiraled from there. One of the most interesting things about this letter that you referenced is that it mentions Dick Durbin from Illinois, who was one of Barack Obama's most hearty supporters. And he is a person who voted with Clinton on this particular amendment. So it is her attempt to sort of lay out, as she sees it, the facts of the matter and try to play down this whole controversy.
Well, yeah, I want to ask John Harwood one more question about Hillary Clinton before we move on to some of the other candidates. It's been reported that we're hearing a more feminine Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail, that she feels free to appeal, to not worry as much about security issues and appeal to perhaps women who haven't embraced her. What's your sense of that? What are you hearing?
Well, first of all, she's done a masterful job of handling the Iraq issue and of conveying an image of strength and not undermining that with an apology for her war vote. And this letter is part of a very well-handled series of events over the course of the year. As for women, women are very important as the base of her candidacy. She is doing much better among women than she is among men. She hopes to do well with Republican women in a general election. So the recently she had a sort of Women's Week, a series of events to court women voters, and it's central to her strategy.
I want to ask you also, John, a couple of questions about that Values Voter Summit over the weekend and how the Republican candidates did. Rudy Giuliani told participants, "You have nothing, absolutely nothing to fear from me." Mitt Romney did not answer direct questions about his more, you know, in the way some hoped he might do a JFK-type speech about his Mormonism. And Ron Paul came in third. So just your sense of how that fared. He came in after Romney and Huckabee.
Rudy Giuliani has so far been able to deflect most of the flack that many of us thought he would be catching over his stance on social issues. He, by all accounts, gave a very respectable performance at the Value Voters Summit. I still think he's facing a reckoning in Iowa in particular, where social conservatives are especially powerful. But what he's got to do is try to convince social conservative voters that his position on security is in tune with them, it's the issue of our time, and that can override some of these other things that might have taken down a Republican nominee in the past.
Yeah. Kay, back to you in Iowa. I know you were at a Polk County Democrats event there on Friday night, I believe. Joe Biden, Bill Richardson, Hillary Clinton all spoke. We always hear from listeners who say, why didn't you ask about, well, candidates like Bill Richardson, for instance, the only candidate who said that he would pull troops immediately out of Iraq when all the Democrats were asked at one point. Are Bill Richardson, John Edwards, I mean, how are they percolating in Iowa?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, John Edwards is statistically in these polls that you see running neck and neck with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton here. Bill Richardson ran some very creative and in some instances funny television ads earlier in the year and did make up some ground in the polls, but he's since fallen a tad bit. Joe Biden has spent a good deal of time here. In fact, he was campaigning here almost all throughout the weekend, and he'll be back this week. He's putting sort of all of his eggs in the Iowa basket right now.
And
neither one of them are making any headway in the polls. I think Iowa Democrats have decided they have three valid choices. They're taking this very seriously. If you ask Iowa Democrats, the election to them started the day after the general election in 2006. They want to pick a winner. They don't want the experience of 2004 of nominating John Kerry and then seeing him falter in the end. So they're taking this really seriously, and you see it by virtue of the crowd sizes at these various events. Democratic crowds are exponentially larger than the crowds that are drawn by these Republican candidates who can sometimes not even muster 100 people in a large city in Iowa.
And Robin, I think it's important to add that because of what Kay just said, it is only Democrats who are skipping Michigan and Florida, those states that moved up in deference to Iowa. They're paying full homage to the Iowa caucuses. some Republicans are hedging their bets. In fact, Rudy Giuliani made a reference last night that Republicans aren't going to abandon Florida. The reason for that is that Rudy Giuliani has a different strategy. He's got a February 5th strategy. He's counting on an early setback and trying to survive that in those further states down the line.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, senior contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal, and Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. Look at that. We're almost out of time. We hardly can mention in passing that fake newsman Stephen Colbert of the Colbert Report is running for president in his home state of South Carolina as both a Democrat and a Republican. Tim Russert actually spoke to him. He said he doesn't want to be president. He just wants to run. There's a difference, he said, as if we don't think there is. But you expect more of these kind of, people who might actually, he did register, people who might actually get a vote or two?
Oh, Stephen Colbert?
Yeah.
You bet he'll get a vote or two.
Especially,
people love that guy.
Especially if, as he says, he asks Senator Larry Craig to join his ticket. John, Kay, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment, here and now. The Space Shuttle Discovery is scheduled for liftoff tomorrow, headed for an ambitious construction project at the International Space Station, one of the few missions left for NASA, which plans to end launches in 2010 and switch to another program. Pat Duggins is long familiar to public radio listeners for his coverage of space shuttle launches, missions, and disasters for over 20 years. Now he's written a book looking at all of it. It's called Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program. And he joins us from WMFE in Orlando, where he's senior news analyst. Pat, welcome as always.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And remind us a little more about where we are on the time continuum here. The shuttle program, as you said, winding down. What's left?
Well, they want to finish the International Space Station, and there are two schools of thought on that. Some think that they can finish it by the spring of 2010. Some think that it may actually go toward the end of NASA's fiscal year, which would be more like September of 2010. But 2010 is it.
Then what's next?
Well, what's next is we're going to be thumbing a lot of rides with the Russians for a while. There's going to be a gap between 2010 and 2015 where we have really no capability of putting human beings of our own up into space. And then maybe around 2015 or so, we're expecting that new gumdrop-shaped capsule, the Orion Crew Exploration Vehicle, or Apollo on steroids, as it's known, to come online, and then Americans should be back in space.
Well, and is this part of the next great frontier, President Bush announcing that he wants the U.S. to go back to the moon and to Mars?
Well, it's getting away from the shuttle, which, as I write in Final Countdown, Apollo worked because it was a mission that went looking for a spacecraft, and the shuttle didn't work because it was a spacecraft that went looking for a mission.
Apollo, of course, being the response to President Kennedy's request for, let's get man to the moon, and so he had the challenge, and they came up with the spaceship.
That's it, exactly. Well, with the shuttle, there really wasn't a specific mission there. They wanted originally to have a two-stage shuttle and a space station. Congress looked at that. They had sticker shock. They said, no space station. You get half the money you want for the shuttle. So basically, for the first 18 years of its life, the space shuttle was kind of like doing grocer's errands up in space. Mm-hmm. So with the new vehicle, NASA hopes to be able to tinker toy together larger spacecraft, go back to the moon definitely, go on to Mars, maybe.
Right. So the next project on the horizon after 2015 is this idea of, finding the capability by building the spaceships to somehow get to Mars ultimately. But so let's talk more about the shuttle mission. As you said, boy, it didn't really sound like glowing praise of the shuttle program. How would you assess it, as you have in the book? What would your headline be?
We spent billions of dollars and killed 14 astronauts, and for what? The spacecraft did keep us in orbit. It did teach us some basic things about long-term living in space, which we'll need to do if we want to go on to the moon and Mars. But even NASA's administrator, Michael Griffin, admits that staying in low Earth orbit, which is what NASA basically was stuck with by Congress, it wasn't the best way to go.
It was supposed to bring up satellites for the Pentagon, perform scientific experiments. How much of that got done?
Some of it. The Pentagon felt, to one degree or another, kind of rooked because they were supposed to have like 30% of all of the shuttle missions would be secret Defense Department flights. Only 7, if I count correctly, actually flew. They were even going to fly shuttles out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. They had a space shuttle crew picked and ready to go. And then all of a sudden, after Challenger, President Reagan took that away. As far as launching satellites, that went away with Challenger 2. And then as far as the experiments are concerned, the analogy that I always draw is it's almost like, my wife and I are going to go on vacation down to Acapulco, and we're going to learn to speak French. because you never know. You might be walking along the beach and you might bump into Catherine Deneuve. Now, it's a small world. It might happen, but the chances of it happening, is it so good that you would want to spend all of the time and the money to acquire that particular skill? Now, you transfer that to space. You have to focus like a laser beam on exactly where you want to go and what you want to do. You can't sort of say, well, we'll kind of sort of maybe go into space and learn things along the way. You have to know specifically what it is that you want to learn before you learn it. And the shuttle did a little bit of that, but really not all that much.
Well, we have to say we spoke recently with astronaut Sunny Williams, who holds the record for the longest time for a woman in space, and she would take exception to that. She and others would say, well, but if we weren't going to go to Mars between the Apollo mission and 2015, we need to sort of almost hold the space, hold the industry together.
That's a fair point. It did. And actually, when NASA first put men on the moon, their plan was to put human beings on the planet Mars by 1984. But then after Apollo 11, supposedly the promise of Apollo, which was to beat the Russians, that's how it was advertised, that kind of went away. So now what does NASA do? Well, they face smaller budgets, and they had to do something to keep Americans in orbit, and that's where the shuttle came along.
And of course, there are people who think it's important to be inspirational, to keep, you know, young kids looking to the heavens. I just want to touch on, you know, two of, you know, the sad stories of the failures of the shuttle. We had the Challenger disaster, and then that was followed by the Space Shuttle Columbia breaking up as it was attempting to land. You covered the investigation into the Columbia disaster, and you've printed some of your photographs in the book, and it's really quite compelling to see these burnt up pieces of spaceship. What was that like for you to cover that?
The photographs that you referred to were taken on a pretty momentous day for NASA, because when I went to that hangar, the gentleman who's in charge of collecting the debris and doing the analysis, Mike Linebach, said, no news today, we're just going to show you the wreckage and everything's fine. And I was perfectly fine with that. And we walked up to the gray heat shields that lined Columbia's leading edge of the left-hand wing. And Mr. Linebach points to one and said, by the way, do you see that one? And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. And he said, that's panel number 8. And I said, okay, that's fine. And he said, see the hole that's there? And I said, yeah. He said, we've determined that that is where a piece of foam hit the side of the shuttle and caused the breach that led to the burn-up and breakup of the spacecraft. And I responded, well, that's amazing. I'd never heard that before. When did you all come up with that conclusion? And he kind of looked at his watch and said, oh, about an hour ago.
Now, how big was the hole?
A hole was about the size of a football.
And you're standing right next to this thing, and it had been, you know, up in this place where, I don't know about you, but I doubt I'll ever go. And all, you know, these wonderful people were dead because of that hole. I mean, that's got to be an eerie.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. But really the one that got me the most is actually the one that showed the frame of the windshield. Because there was nothing there, but the glass was gone. It was just the metal that surrounded the glass. And obviously the crew cabin and the rest of the shuttle was gone. But it really struck me as poignant that the very last thing that that Rick Husband and Willie McCool, the two astronauts, the commander and pilot, saw was through those windows, and now they're gone. So that for me, of all the photographs, that's the one that is the most poignant for me.
Do you think the U.S. is going to Mars? Do you think man is going to Mars?
It depends on whether or not we've got the national will. My concern is, and I write about this in the epilogue, is that what might possibly, probably happen in NASA is that we'll go back to the moon and then Congress is going to say, okay, that's enough. At which time NASA is going to be beaten up by critics who say they have achieved nothing more than what our grandparents did with slide rules back in the 1960s. There's a whole slew of new technical problems that are going to go along with a trip to Mars, most notably just simply the time. I mean, the first Mars mission is going to circle around Mars and come back, kind of like Apollo 8 did back in 1968. And can you imagine trying to hire astronauts to be able to make that kind of a trip where you're missing your family for up to a year, going to Mars, circling, but not landing? There are a lot of people out there that think it's going to be very tough picking a crew for that.
Huh. We've been talking about the Space Shuttle program and the future of NASA with Pat Duggins. His new book is Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program. Pat, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
All right, and before the hour is up today, we'll speak with author Shalom Auslander about growing up with a vengeful God. One critic says Shalom sounds like Philip Roth's angry nephew. You're listening to Here and Now. The America, Northwest Passage, that traditionally ice-locked route from the Atlantic to the Pacific across the top of the world. Spencer Tracy went looking for it in the 1940 film. Hundreds have tried to navigate it since the first recorded attempt in 1497. And the Canadian Coast Guard fiercely protects it for fear another country will take over this potentially lucrative trade route. But earlier this year, Roger Swanson sailed right through it. The Wall Street Journal reports that more recreational boats have crossed the passage in the last 6 years than in the preceding century because global warming has reduced deadly ice flows. And Roger Swanson joins us from his home in Minnesota to tell us more. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you.
And I said sailed through it. You actually used a motor some of the time, but this was not your first attempt. Tell us what happened during previous attempts. I know you tried once in 1994. Why was it so hard to navigate the Northwest Passage?
The passage tends to be ice-blocked most of the year. In fact, generally, it is only toward the end of August, first of September, that historically it's ever opened up. And, of course, that is the time that we tried to do it. You mentioned sailing and motoring. We are a sailboat, but we also have an engine. And so at the times when there is no wind, which is fairly often in the Arctic, we would be motoring and then or motor sailing.
Yeah. We understand you tried again in 2005. Now, this makes me feel very claustrophobic. We understand you tried to sort of squeeze through a seam in the ice, and you got stuck.
Well, we generally call it a lead. That's when the ice opens. In the Canadian Arctic, we're primarily dealing with pack ice, which is frozen seawater. The pack ice lies low in the water, and it might only be a foot above and maybe 4 feet below or even less below the surface. We were going through Franklin Strait, which is about the middle of the passage, and the ice had opened so that it appeared that we might be able to get through. Then the wind changed and the ice closed on us, and we were able to find a sheltered cove, which was quite safe, so we weren't in danger of being crushed by the ice. However, the ice outside prevented us from getting out.
Being crushed by the ice, that would be bad.
We
understand there have been a lot of people who've died attempting the passage. People have had to turn back and stay quite a while up in the north before they can get through. But you tell us about this last trip. What happened?
Both the 94 and the 05 trip, we were turned back by the ice and had to go back. The reason we tried it this year, I didn't think I would try it again, but we got reports that there was significantly less ice last year. So after two tries, my wife and I decided we'd try it one more time. And this time we found practically no ice, which was quite surprising.
We're reading in the Wall Street Journal that Arctic ice has receded by nearly 40,000 square miles a year in this area. This past summer, there was less ice than during any other time in the century. And I'm wondering if maybe there's some sadness there for you as well. Melting ice, we know, jeopardizes polar bears. It signifies big problems in other areas. But you're an adventurer, so did it also make the Northwest Passage not as adventurous as it once was?
Well, that's true. In some ways, we were almost a little disappointed that we didn't see more ice. It was a little hard to be ecstatic and disappointed at the same time. But nevertheless, there was a little bit of that.
You're in your 70s, do I understand?
That's true. I'm 76.
And there with your wife. What was the pull of the Northwest Passage? Again, your third try, you're in your 70s.
Well, they say the high latitudes seem to have an attraction. I can't tell you why, whether it's the challenge, the fascination, certainly the beauty. It is very beautiful. In a sense, maybe the most beautiful ice is on the west coast of Greenland, where you have these huge, towering icebergs. There's something about the feeling of total isolation, nothing but ice and water. It's just very special.
What were you thinking when you realized you'd made it?
Well, any feeling of a great accomplishment had to be tempered by the dangerous waters that we knew were ahead in the Bering Sea. Some of the worst weather I've ever experienced came the day before we arrived in Kodiak. So it's never over till it's over.
Yeah. Roger Swanson recently arrived back from his boat trip through the Northwest Passage. Thank you so much for speaking with us about your trip.
Well, I appreciate your interest, and I enjoyed talking to you, Robin.
Jeremiah had to be one of the most miserable characters in the Bible. Here's one of his thoughts. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, a baby boy has been born to you, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave. I picture an old man shaking his fist at God in the sky, surrounded by rubble and ruin. Well, transfer that image to Spring Valley, New York, circa 1975. Make the man a small kid with a balled-up fist and a yarmulke. Throw in a few F-words, and you have the recurring theme of Shalom Auslander's new book, Foreskin's Lament, his story of growing up in an isolated Orthodox Jewish family with a verbally abusive dad and the constant threat of a punishing God.
When I was a child, my parents and teachers told me about a man who was very strong. They told me he could destroy the whole world. They told me he could lift mountains. They told me he could part the sea. It was important to keep the man happy. When we obeyed what the man had commanded, the man liked us. He liked us so much that he killed anyone who didn't like us. But when we didn't obey what he had commanded, he didn't like us. He hated us. Some days he hated us so much he killed us. Other days he let other people kill us. We call these days holidays.
As Auslander writes, "I believe in God. It's been a real problem for me." His book is One Man's Not-So-Good Experience with Fundamentalism, and Shalom Auslander joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
I don't think I've ever heard God so cursed as you as a little kid. Tell us some of the things that you believed you were told that God expected of you as a child. It gets very complicated.
Well, there are 613 commandments to begin with, and so there's the combination of how much you're supposed to do with how off-the-wall furious he gets when you don't do it. For me, the five books of Moses might be called the big book of or else, because you either do these things or else I'm going to flood the world, or else I'm going to make you slaves in Egypt, or else, or else, or else.
And now I rush to say, we know that there are true believers who steadfastly feel that, you know, it's the word of God. It's not some sort of, you know, threat or warning. It's something that's prodding them to live a better life. But for you, the specifics of eating, walking, what were some of the things that you do?
There are endless blessings, endless things that you have to do.
Can't walk four steps, beyond four steps without a yarmulke.
You can't walk four steps without a yarmulke. On Saturday, you're not allowed to walk 2,000 cubits, which comes to about, I think, 8,000 feet. I'm not sure.
And here you are, a kid who, you know, you have a Steve Austin doll, you know, the $6 million man. You want to go to the mall. It's very difficult for you.
You're in the real world at the same time that you're living in the biblical world. So there are malls and there are interesting things to do, and there are Saturdays. And so we're completely isolated. I'm walking along these sort of rural streets in the town that I grew up, and I always wondered what the people in the cars possibly could be thinking. First of all, of us walking along the streets in suits and hats and prayer shawls. We were taught that we were God's favorite, but God's unchosen seemed to be having a much better time. They could go out on Saturday. They could have a barbecue. They could have a cheeseburger and a milkshake.
How much did this, you know, increasing anger at God, at what you viewed as this punishing God, come from your view of your dad, who was, you know, very angry man? And maybe I'm wondering, maybe you thought God must be exponentially that much angrier than my dad.
Well, I have memories of a good father, and something clicked and something switched. He began to drink. He began to get violent. All of a sudden, the father on earth began to look a lot like the father in heaven that I was told about. I'd always been told that God was angry. I mean, the very first chapter, they eat an apple, he goes off the wall. I mean, he just loses it. He floods the earth. The guy's nuts. So all of a sudden, the father on earth starts to behave the same way. So I can't pull these strands of rope apart and know which was the first. All I know is that I've lived with a furious maniac in my head that is constantly threatening me and is constantly a worry.
Well, and that's you as an adult. You start to write this book after you've broken away from your family, you have a child, and you paint this picture of yourself as an adult who just cannot stop the horror film reel going in your head, even after you broke from your family.
It's going on in my head as we speak.
Right now.
It is absolutely exhausting. And writing the book was cathartic. It wasn't curative. It didn't stop any of this.
As a little kid, you attempt to sort of subvert the whole thing by what? Eating Slim Jims because they have meat and you'd never eaten them before. You start shoplifting. You know, what are some of the things that you did to try to, you know, almost tempt God? Okay, God, do it. You know?
Well, the very first thing I was told by rabbis that until you're 13, every sin you commit gets attributed to your father's account. I just sort of put two and two together and decided if I start sinning a lot, then God might just come after my father.
What were some of the things you did?
I cursed a lot. I took my yarmulke off and walked back and forth across the room a few times. I kept waiting for this lightning bolt to strike, and it didn't happen.
Yeah. Is your father still alive?
Yeah.
Because I also had a lot of sympathy for him in the book. He just couldn't seem to have any pleasure in anything. Well, having written this, having, you know, this is out in public now, what about your dad? I mean, what is your family?
This is a really cruel way to raise kids. This is a really, to teach kids this stuff, and they are taught it. I know that there are wonderful aspects to religion, but those all seem secondary to the threat. And whatever religion you're talking about, it just seems to me, people who come over to me now and say, I just found religion, I have none of that. Well, yeah, you're an adult. You can go and find the things you want to find. So in the first place, to teach someone that is incredibly cruel. And
the orthodoxy, the fundamentalist.
The fundamentalist, whether it's Revelations, Old Testament, Quran, it's not something that you get over. And it's not something you can just shut off, even though you decide as an adult, I'm above this, I'm beyond this. So it's an incredibly painful thing to go through, as funny as it seems, and I couldn't come up with any other way to write it because it is so insane. But as far as my father is, I haven't spoken to my family in a long time.
That's sad.
Well, as I say in the book, it's not as sad as when I do.
Yeah. And you have a son now. What about him? You're going to raise him in a faith? You're going to tell him will he have his grandparents? Because you keep having to make decisions.
Yeah. I know that I'm not going to tell him that when you sin, God floods the world. He turns 3 in a month, and he's never heard any of that. So I consider that at least an early victory in the war. But I don't know what I'm going to tell him. I know that my family won't be in the picture. That this is who we are, and this is the team we go forth with, and we're very happy. I know that if I find out that we've put him in a school or a program, and he comes home and he says, "Teacher told me today that God gets angry when you do blank." I might just have my own furious vengeance at that point on the teacher, because to me it's abuse. And in the book I refer to it as theological abuse, and I do believe that it is. Literally, you wouldn't raise your kid on Stephen King movies. You wouldn't start showing them that when they were 3 years old, and that is what they do.
Have you tried the thought of a God that just is only love?
I've tried to picture it, but, you know, once you've got this guy in your head, he's very likely to kill the nice God, because the nice God seems like a bit of a wuss.
Shalom Auslander. His memoir is Foreskin's Lament. For more on the book, go to our website, here-now.org. I wish you well.
Thank you.
Shalom.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.